Welcome back to I'm Interested. I'm Mike Greenberg, and I am delighted that you're with me here today. And I hope that you enjoyed, if you are a regular listener of this podcast, our little detour from the world of sports last week with James Murray from the Impractical Jokers, which is a show that I continue to love. And I really enjoyed talking to him and getting a little more insight into his understanding of the way they are sort of an oasis from the desert of nastiness that the world seems to be. This week we go back to our meat and potatoes, if you will, in the sports world. And my interview is with Jay Wright, the head basketball coach at Villanova. They've won two of the last three national championships. And I want to tell you, as I introduce Jay here, that while this is the fifth podcast that we are bringing to you, this is actually the first one that we recorded. You will hear him talking about the Italian restaurant in Brooklyn, where we sat and chatted for an hour talking about so many things with the extraordinarily interesting, extraordinarily successful, and yes, I'll say it so you don't have to, the extraordinarily handsome coach of Nova, Jay Wright. So the first thing is that I asked you where you would like this conversation to take place, and we are in a restaurant called Michael's in the Marine Park neighborhood of Brooklyn. So I'm interested to know, why are we here?
Well, this is one of my favorite restaurants in New York, and I haven't been able to get here as often. But the owner of this restaurant was a graduate assistant coach for me, Mike Kakachi. And he was a young guy that I met at Brooklyn Poly Prep as an assistant coach. His family owns the restaurant. And he was a Brooklyn guy that thought, like, my whole family's in the restaurant business, but I think I want to be a coach. And he came down with us for Villanova for 2 years, got his master's degree, worked his butt off. And little things like he couldn't find a place close enough to campus to get fresh pasta. So I would hear people tell me, your assistant is sitting alone in an Italian restaurant. You're like 3 miles from school. He comes down here and eats by himself. And I would say to him, Mike, why are you going all the way down there? He goes, it's the only place that's got fresh pasta. I got to eat fresh pasta. So he did a great job for us, but after he said, you know what? I miss the family business. You know, I think I'm a restaurant guy. So he came back with his family here. So I always like to come here. We had my son's confirmation dinner here after we played St. John's, because in the coaching business, my son gets confirmed on a Saturday in Philadelphia, but we play St. John's that afternoon. So I missed the confirmation. The whole family goes to the confirmation, takes a bus up to the St. John's game, and then a bus here to Michael's to celebrate. So it's a special place.
You just took me to a place I had absolutely no intention of going, which is the way interesting conversations should go.
Right.
So that balance. So you missed your son's confirmation. Now you are everybody knows above you as a family man and your long marriage and all of that, how important that is to you. And anyone who spends any time around you sees how important that is to you. So how do you balance that? How did you feel missing your son's confirmation?
It kills me. Like it's the toughest part of coaching. Coaching is a great job, but the essence of coaching is you're developing guys in really formative years of their lives from 18 to 22. While you're doing that, your kids are growing up, your own kids. And sometimes you find yourself sitting in a gym watching a 16-year-old that you know probably is not going to be good enough to play for you, but you have to be there. So he's probably not going to play for you. And your son is 16. He's playing in his high school game that's very important to him, and you're not there. Missing a confirmation, you know, it's a big part of a Catholic family. It's a big thing, you know. And your whole family has to get a bus to leave the church in Philadelphia, come up here to watch a St. John's game. Thank God we won. Mm-hmm. And then come here in Brooklyn and celebrate everybody from Philly. So it is the hardest part for me of my job. And it's just, I struggle with it every day.
What conversations do you have with your kids about that? Because obviously they accept it. They know it. So many wonderful things come with your father being the basketball coach at Villanova and being who you are. But obviously there are pluses and minuses to everything. What kinds of conversations?
Well, there's a lot of pluses, too. When they're younger and they're growing up around, you know, these guys, you're on a college campus, you know, you're inspired by academia, you're growing up around college athletes that are very committed, that's good, and they're always great with the kids.
Yeah.
But then when they start playing their own sports, people know who they are. I remember my sons being in games and kids chanting, who's your father? Who's your father? And then chanting, to my younger son, you know, your brother is better, your brother, you know, and just, or Nova stinks, Nova stinks, while the kid's playing a high school basketball game.
Right.
So you're watching all that. So I'd always talk to my, I would say, like, how, you all right with that? You know, you, and like, hey, Dad, don't worry about it. I got it. I got it. But still to this day, so Taylor, my oldest, is 25. Colin is 24. I just had dinner with Dick Vermeil's sons. And one of the questions I asked them was, how was it growing up? I said, you're, because I want to see now if they're, if, even if they're still affected now.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did, I think we did all right. Thank God for my wife, Patty. I think we did okay. They're in good shape, but I still worry about it to this day.
It's understandable. Okay. Let's get to the things that I meant to talk about today. So when people talk about and think about Jay Wright, the first thing that comes to mind is the clothes. I'm not interested in that. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not that interested in talking about that. You've won two championships. I'm not that interested in talking about that. You got a ton of great players. I'm not that interested in talking about that. Here's the first thing I'm interested in. Every time your team breaks a huddle, they say the word attitude. You wrote a book. After you win the championship, it's called Attitude. What does the word attitude mean to you?
It's the most important aspect of our program. I always wear an attitude wristband. But if I meet somebody, and I just met a little kid in the hotel, if I meet somebody that I think's got a great attitude or could be inspired, I get, take it off and give it to them. So I don't have it on. But we look at it this way, that you have control of certain things in your life. And even as a basketball player, you don't control whether you're 6'7 or 6'2. You really don't even control whether you have a 40-inch vertical or 28. You can improve it, but a lot of it's God-given. So what you do control every day is your effort and your attitude every day. And we practice in practice. Everything we do is set up to teach guys how they respond after a positive play, what is their attitude on the next play, and how do they respond after a negative play? What's their attitude? And then when they're young as freshmen, they are interested in basketball. That helps them in basketball. But as they get a little older and they understand it impacts life, we want them to live their life the same way. Every day, and I wake up in the morning, what do I have control of? My effort and my attitude. That's it. Who knows what's going to happen to me? But if I know I can control my attitude, how I respond to everything, that's the greatest characteristic I can have.
Where did you learn that?
First, it started with my father. My father would always talk to me about how you handle situations. You know, it was just as important as how you handle a negative situation. You know, I remember having a good game as a player in high school, and I'd come back and to the house, and my dad say, "You play like a soft suburban kid." You know, like you're out there acting like you're, you know, all fancy. You know, it's more important how you conduct yourself during the game. He didn't put a word on it. But then John Chaney, if you remember John Chaney Temple, he had in Philadelphia, he had these billboards that said, "Winning is an attitude." They used to be up in Philly. And I like that, right? So as I started coaching at Hofstra as a head coach, we were bad in the beginning. When we got the job, we were 295 out of 302 teams. And the kids were giving us all the effort they could, but we were just bad. We were a bad team. But I was like, what? We shouldn't be feeling bad about ourselves. They can't do any more. They're giving me everything they got. What can we feel good about? We can feel good about is we're coming in with a great attitude every day. Then I started to put it together, and we started that at Hofstra. We would say 1-2-3 attitude. We knew we were going to lose. So we'd say, hey, we wouldn't say it, but we knew it. We would say, hey, all we can control here tonight is our attitude. Like, yeah, if we're down 5, let's look at the next possession. So then we just kept building on it, and it worked for us, and it became a big part of our program.
The other bracelets, if I understand it correctly, that you have are humble and hungry. And so is that a similar concept?
This will be the only time I don't have it on. I just gave it to kids in the hotel. Attitude usually refers to when things aren't going well, you control your attitude, and you can have a positive attitude. It's all about how you approach the next step. But it's just as – so when we were just building it, we were losing a lot. So attitude was way more important. But as we got successful, how we handled that was important too. And we realized that in life, how you handle a good day, right, or – a successful day is just as important. And And so our Humble and Hungry became important, that even though we're having success as a team, or even if you win a game, how we approach the next day, we have humility. It doesn't make us any better than anybody else. And even though we're having success, we have to stay hungry to continue to improve. So like all the guys, when they're getting drafted, we keep talking to them about, stay humble and hungry. That's, even though you're getting close to reaching your dreams, you got more goals. You got to stay humble and you got to stay hungry to keep getting better.
That's fascinating to me. And I think the hardest thing in the world to do. So I started out in the business covering Michael Jordan's teams, and people ask me about him all the time. And what I always say is he was the most determined person I've ever been around in my entire life. He managed to keep that. Is that something you think can be taught? Like he was the most famous person, I believe, on the planet at the time that I covered him. And he was the best player ever.
I agree.
And yet he treated practice every single day the way a lot of other guys, I think, would treat game 7 of the NBA Finals. Do you think that's something that just is inside of you? Are you just born with that, or is that something that can be taught?
Well, I think he is the greatest example, and I used to use him as the example all the time, but now that kids don't relate to him. LeBron.
Do they not? Do the kids that you coach not know much about Michael Jordan?
No, they know.
Yeah.
They know, but they don't know that.
Right.
But if at that time when he was playing, even if you didn't realize what he was doing, it impressed you that guy every day, you could see, even when he had bad nights, he wasn't making shots, he'd be a killer at the end of the game, you know? He had the greatest attitude ever. I can't use that now with our guys, but we try to teach exactly what Michael Jordan is. And it's not, it can't be through basketball. It can't be you have to practice hard every day. It's got to be you have to live your life as a person that is a humble person, that whatever you're doing, you want to improve and grow. We use the word lifetime. You want to be a lifetime learner. We talk to our guys about, you know, we have a triangle. We say, it says play hard, play smart, play together, play with pride. That's at the top. But then we tell them, that's how you want to live. You want to live with great enthusiasm and passion. You want to live thinking about others. You want to be a lifetime learner. And you always want to take pride in what you're a part of, not your individual success. So we do try to teach them that.
We'll continue in just a moment with more of my conversation with Jay Wright. But first, I want to tell you about LinkedIn. So I've been telling you the right hire can make a huge impact on your business. And that's why it's so important to find the right person. But the question is, where do you find that individual? You could try posting on job boards, but can you really be sure the right person is going to see that job? Instead, find the person who will help you grow your business with LinkedIn. As the world's largest professional network, people go to LinkedIn literally every day to grow professionally and discover job opportunities. 70% of the U.S. workforce is already there. LinkedIn Jobs matches people to your role based on more of who they really are, their skills, their interests, and even how open they are to new opportunities. This way, your job gets seen by more of the right people. Most LinkedIn members haven't recently visited the top job boards, but 9 out of 10 members are open to new opportunities, so you can only reach them on LinkedIn. That's why a new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn. And businesses rate LinkedIn 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates. So do this. Hurry to LinkedIn.com/Greeny right now. You get $50 off your first job post. That's LinkedIn.com/Greeny. Get $50 off your first job post. LinkedIn.com/Greeny. Terms and conditions apply.
I read in preparation for this, I found the most fascinating interview with you in GQ magazine from March of 2017. Actually, Josh Macri, our producer, found it and sent it to me, and it is just fascinating. And I want to read a sentence from it that I thought was really interesting. He wrote, "To spend some fly-on-the-wall time backstage with a major college basketball program is to marvel at the diversity of decisions that confront the head coach. He is a CEO, toiling at a strange and singular work, running a lucrative persnickety operation." So I'm interested to know, I mean, you're a basketball coach, right? You I'm assuming are most comfortable in sweats with a whistle.
Definitely.
And you're what percentage of your time is spent actually coaching basketball?
Mike, I could talk about this for hours, but now that we've had some success, it is probably my second greatest challenge to still staying humble and hungry and staying committed to my family is making sure I'm coaching Villanova basketball and being on the court with our guys. I've never missed a practice or individual workout because I feel like they're coming to play for me. But with all that said, you know, I'm here with you, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to the draft, and we had NABC foundation meeting, dinner. So you have to do that. But to answer your question clearly, I would say as a college basketball coach, time on the court with the players would be about 30% of your time. 30%. And, you know, I have young coaches that we have a position on our staff called Director of Player Development. It's an endowed position for former players that think they might want to be a coach. Because everybody thinks, hey, I watch it on TV, that looks like fun. Mm-hmm. But we have had four guys in that position. Three of them have gone on to the NBA as coaches because they said, this college coaching, I had no idea you were doing all this stuff when we were in the dorms.
Mm-hmm.
And only one, Mike Nardi, who's on our staff now, decided to stay in college because college coaching is part of education, fundraising, recruiting, a lot of recruiting, a lot of life skills, just talking with the guys. Not pro basketball is you're on the court with those guys coaching basketball.
Yeah, it's more about the games, and yours is more about all sorts of other things that go on. All right, another thing that I thought was really interesting in this interview in GQ. This is a quote from you. After winning the first championship, you win one national championship, and now you have all the answers. All the attention is really scary because it's intoxicating. That was after you won the first championship. Between then and now, you win another title, and you go from being a well-known coach to being the guy. I mean, right now, would you ask someone, name a college basketball coach, probably most people would say Mike Krzyzewski, and then they're going to say Jay Wright.
That's nice.
That's just the reality. That's the life you lead now. So tell me about the intoxicating part and how you have to combat whatever comes with that.
I guess what we talked about before, that's the challenge, right? Is in 2009, we went to the Final Four. And in our business, going to a Final Four kind of – it's a crowning achievement in our business. Mm-hmm. I don't know, would you say that way in the media? Yeah. They look at it that way?
Well,
coaches do.
For a coach to make the Final Four, yes. Yeah. It is a distinguishing factor. Yes. He has coached in a Final Four.
What would be something in your business that would do that?
There isn't really
No?
I mean, I guess being at ESPN, probably, because the business is a really big business. There are thousands of people all over the country right now that probably could do my job as well as I do it in a variety of circumstances. Are the reason that I'm at ESPN and they're in other places. So it's probably something
like that. Yeah, and the Final Four is the same way. There's a lot of – John Chaney's never been to a Final Four.
Right.
There's been a lot of great coaches. So in our business, and that's really what I care about, what coaches think it's big. So when we went there in 2009, I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Now I've kind of proven myself. And, you know, everything comes at you. And I thought, okay, now – I got to be what Villanova people want their coach to be. I got to be like John Calipari, Mike Krzyzewski. I got to try to do that now. That's my job. Not ego-wise. I just thought that's what they want me to be. And I started, you know, we started recruiting that way. I started living that way. And it almost broke our program. It almost broke our program. So then when we won, I knew we luckily got it back. But when we won, I knew that I had been through that. And I knew that it got intoxicating. And so it was a fight after we won it to not get caught up in what people thought you should be, what people say about you. Stay true to who you are. And we did a pretty good job. And I think that's why we got to the second one. Now, the second one notches it up. And I got to keep fighting it. It's not, you know, like our team's going to the ESPYs. We got four or five nominated. I went last time. I'm going to go. I'm sending the team. They love it. I'm going to recruit. It's a recruiting time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I loved it too. I went there, but I work for Villanova. You know, I want to be with my family, coach my team. That's where I can't let the intoxication affect me.
Humble and hungry. You know, I remember the first year that we were doing Mike and Mike was the year Tom Izzo and Michigan State won the championship. Right. And I remember we ran an interview that Dick Vitale did with him, and Dickie V, as only Dickie V can, is just yelling at him, your life is going to change! Your life is going to change! And so I've always asked people, like, how did your life change? Can you give me an example of the way your life changes when you go from being a well-known coach to now you mentioned before, the Final Four is one thing, now you've won the championship. Yeah. What's one example of the way your life can change?
Well, you make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, we always talk to these kids about, hey, when you go to the NBA, don't let this money change you. You know, stay humble and hungry. Hell, I'm, you know, I don't know. I was like 53 or something, 52 when we won it. I'm 52. And all of a sudden you start making money like that. It changes. You're able to do things you couldn't do. You know, and you don't want it. That's just one reason. People recognize you everywhere. You know, Philly's a great town. You know, it's a pro town, but they love college basketball. First time in your life, you go into places, people come up to you, they ask you for autographs. It's fun for a few times, but then when your kids are with you and you've been on the road for a week recruiting, you finally got your family together, you're having dinner, people are coming up. It finally hits me. All right, now I realize why some of those other people, when they wouldn't give autographs, I would think, come on, man, what's wrong with you? Give the guy an autograph.
Right.
But I didn't realize that guy's been away from his family for 2 weeks, so you got to deal with that. Like, those kind of things you never think about, but they start hitting you.
And selfies are the new autographs now. Oh. They used to be autographs. Now everyone wants to take a picture.
Better point. That's a better point. It's way more selfies.
And that's more intrusive.
Autographs.
I mean, again, I don't want to make it sound like it's the worst thing in the world, and I'm not nearly as famous as you are, but people want to take a picture, and that just takes a little more time, and it just sort of is what it is. Are you now at a point where most places you go, you have to make some sort of prearrangement? Like, you walk in the door here, and everyone knows who you are. Everyone waves, and they leave you alone. For the most part, if you want to go out with your family to a dinner, to a movie, to whatever it is, are you okay just walking into a restaurant?
Yeah. Philly's a good town, though. That's what I love about Philly. It's a pro town. Basketball, college basketball is important, but Eagles, Phillies, that's like, I know I've talked to John Calipari, Bill, something. When you live in a small college town like that, it's much more difficult. And that's part of what I love about our job at Villanova. It's even Villanova people, they keep it under control, but there's new challenges. It being at the beach in the summer, like one of the things I love to be at the Jersey Shore is go work out. I had to find a place I could go by myself now. That's new.
Because
everybody talks to you, and I love people.
Right.
Like you. I'll take selfies. But if you put yourself in that situation, then you're going to have to do it. So don't put yourself in that situation.
Right. I often think about that. Like, to be, and I'm not asking anyone to feel sorry for them, but to be LeBron James, to be Michael Jordan. I remember I was in, about a year and a half ago, I was in a restaurant in Palm Beach, Florida, and Michael Jordan walked in. And I remember they had to like usher him aside. And I mean, I've known Michael Jordan for 25 years. And so I went over and said a quick hello, but they've got to move him. Like it's almost like the Secret Service to get him from one place to another. And I thought to myself, that would be a very unusual way to live your life. Don't you think?
It looks, even for my whole coaching career, it looks like it would be fun.
Right.
And like you said, we have another saying, don't tell anybody your problems.
Right.
Because 80% of people don't care, and the other 20% are happy you have them.
Right.
So it's like you and I talking about this, it's not that anybody should feel sorry for us.
No.
We love where we are, but it is a part of it. Everything comes with a sacrifice. And like you said, our level compared to a Michael Jordan or LeBron, it's really intrusive. And it changes how you can live. You can't say, hey, you can't call your guys, hey guys, I'll meet you down at Michael's and let's get dinner. You can't do that.
Right.
It changes your life.
Okay, so I want you to tell this story that I will admit I didn't know for some reason. And I covered the Final Four when you won the championship game, the first one. I did not know that your team threw you out of the locker room at halftime. Tell me that story.
Yeah. They didn't let me in. We did not play a good first half against North Carolina in the 16 championship game. And our guys knew it. We did not, we were good all year at following a game plan. Really smart guys, really committed. We did not follow the game plan in the first half, and the guys knew it. So we were coming to the locker room, and you know, you have that long, long walk in those arenas, and they all got ahead of me. And we were coming to the locker room, and everybody knew it. So when I got to the door, Daniel Chefu, our senior, closed the door. He said, Coach, I got this. Now, Daniel Chefu, who was a great leader, but could get a little wacky. And we had some incidents during the year. Nothing bad, but we knew he was overly competitive. The assistants look at me like, no way. No way. Don't let him do this. And it was a real defining moment for us where I'm looking at my whole staff and they're saying, no way do you let him talk to the team. And I was like, I said, nah, let him go. Let him go. And my assistants were dying. And I really wasn't sure about it, but I just felt like it was, I had to make a quick decision. You know, it was either I have to fight with him and grab the door or bang to come in. I was like, let him go because I want to act calm here. And I could hear him in there yelling at them, but basically giving the message that I would give. And in the Final Four, those half times are extra long. They're 20 minutes. We have the 15-minute timeout, 15-minute halftime. We have that broken down. So I was able to come in and just say, hey, guys, Daniel's right. Daniel's absolutely right. What he said is right. And he took up some time, but we had extra time. So I said, let's everybody calm down here. You guys get drinks. Get yourselves ready. The staff will go meet. Because we were listening at the door. Right. We were listening to him. So we didn't get to talk because we wanted to see what he said. Let's calm down. And the staff went and met, and then we came back in and real simple about we got to get back to our game plan. So it really worked, but it was a difficult decision. It worked out well. I would be interesting if what my staff would be thinking about me if it didn't, because they were totally against it, and I was kind of with them, but I felt like I didn't have a choice.
Did it feel? When it's happening, because again, I read this. I had never heard this. I don't know why I never heard it. I don't know. Was it well known? Was that something you talked about a lot after it happened?
I think I wrote it in our book.
So it's fascinating to me. So while it was happening, did you have time to process it? Like, this is the championship game. My team is in there.
No.
One of the players is addressing them. And I'm, for all intents and purposes, locked out.
No, I am.
Like, this is a scene in a movie.
Yeah, it is. Because my only choice would have been, like, bang on the door. Hey. And fight with him when I went, because he was a really he wouldn't have just taken, hey, Daniel, shut up right now, because he's so competitive in a positive way. He would have been arguing with me like, no, coach, we're not doing this, we're not doing that. So I felt backed into a corner, you know, and also, you know, in front of your assistants, you look like, hey, he's giving in. And you know that. Daniel and I had gone at it before. So they know that. So, and usually I would never back down, and they know that, and so does Daniel. So I did. I said, you know, no, let him go. And then we're at the door listening, and they can hear him. He starts off in a rage of profanities, you know, and they're looking at me like, you know, get in there. I was like, let him go. And then he got to some relevant points, and it worked out fine. But at the time you're doing it, you act like you're under control, but you're in more of a panic.
You win on this unbelievable play. You win on one of the most famous plays in college basketball history. Do you remember the first conversation you had with Daniel afterwards? And the game is over. You've won. That moment happened. Did you find each other? Did you say anything about the halftime?
Yeah. After you win, there's so much time with the celebration on the court and everything that goes on there, I don't think is that meaningful. Like you embrace, and usually you're just saying, I love you. We did it. There's not really meaningful conversations. You go up and do all. It's about 45 minutes before you get back to the locker room,
right?
And that's, you know, we hold hands and pray, and that's when we talk. Like I can get emotional now thinking about it, and that's when it's meaningful, you know. So we do that, and then you just kind of go around to each guy, and then when I got to him, we kind of laughed. Like he was a tough guy. A really positive, good guy. But as I said, in practice sometimes, his over-competitiveness, he could lose a little bit. And the only one that could control him was me. So when we embraced, I was kind of like, you were good, man. You were good. And it was kind of my way of saying, like, you know, you've had some crazy moments, but you pulled it out here. I said, you were really good. And, you know, he was just emotional. I love you, coach. I love you. That was about it. But he knew what I meant.
You almost got emotional there. Thinking of what specifically? What is it about it that makes you emotional?
Being in the locker room with the guys, that's what it's all about. It's not the game. It's not what goes on out there. It's those guys. It's really cool. It's really cool.
It's got to be. In all honesty, that's the part of it I regret. Like people ask me, I have the greatest job in the world. Right. But I always say if I had it to do over again, if I had known that there were going to be people like Theo Epstein and Brian Cashman who never played, who could have actually been in the arena in one way or another, I would have done that. Because what I'll never know is that. Like this is a podcast. You can't see it. But coaches, obviously, you have tears in your eyes. You're emotional remembering it. That's something I'll never have. Yeah. You know, if teams I root for win, I'm incredibly excited, and then like I'm looking around, and I didn't really do anything. You know, like that's a feeling I'll never know.
It's what every coach that I get emotional about that, but every coach that goes into TV, I always ask them, because I always think about, all right, what the hell am I going to do? You know, I love this. I don't want to stop, but they're in TV, and I say, how do you like it? They say, oh, I love it. It's great, but I miss the competition. I miss being with the guys. I remember Jim Valvano, when he was dying of cancer, Coach Massimino was the head coach at UNLV. We brought great. We had a Midnight Madness. It was Jim Valvano, Mike Fratello, Tommy Lasorda, and Dick Versace. They were our coaches for Midnight Madness. We honored Jimmy V. He was close to dying.
Yeah,
and we had him talk to the team, and we're in the locker room, and he shows us a shunt he's got in his chest, and he says, "You know what, guys? This is what I miss." I miss being in the locker room. I mean, he's close to dying. He goes, I miss being in the locker room with the guys. And it was just us guys in there, you know. And it's something as a coach you can't describe to anybody. And it's why does Larry Brown keep coming back and coaching? Why does he take a job in Italy? That feeling, why does Rolly Massimino coach till he dies, literally on the court? That bond is so special, and you love it.
I do love it. Okay, I want to read one more quote. This is early in your
emotional
career.
Emotional in a podcast. Am I an idiot?
No, it's, huh? It's this is everyone is very excited, I think. So in this portion of the article, again, I want to give all the credit in the world to the writer, Larry Platt, in a March 13th, 2017 edition of GQ. It's one of the most fascinating interviews I've ever read with a person in my life. But so I guess early in your career, your teams weren't winning the way you wanted them to, and you figured out that X's and O's are all basically the same. Everyone's got, for the most part, I'm paraphrasing now, but this is essentially what you're saying. X's and O's, everyone's got them, and everyone's doing some variations on the same theme. But, quote, we spend a lot of time on how we react mentally to every situation. Yeah. So you touched on that earlier, but let's just go to finish here. Let's go a little bit more deeply into that. How do you do that? I watch kids play basketball all the time, and I see kids, you know, they miss a bunch of shots, their heads are down, they're walking, you know, whatever it is. How do you coach that? How do you teach that, and what does it do?
It takes discipline on the coaching staff's part. So we have a back stairwell that you come out of our office, you're down a back stairwell to go onto the practice court. And painted on the wall as we walk down the steps says, we practice to create habits that will enable us to be successful in the most difficult situations. Those habits are how do we react? How do we think? And then before we walk out to the door, it says success is our team playing Villanova basketball for 40 minutes for each other. It's reminding our staff every day when we go on the practice court, what are we doing here today? We are teaching them the habits and creating habits on how they mentally handle every situation. Now the players come down a different hallway. The same saying. We practice to create habits that will enable us to be successful in most difficult situations. And there is, when you go through the double doors to go into practice court for the players, it says at the top, every day I thank the good Lord for making me a Wildcat. I stole that from the Yankees.
Yeah.
Remember Derek Jeter's Gatorade? Remember that piece they did when he retired?
Yeah.
And they showed him standing on the steps with that of the,
I thank the good Lord for making me a Yankee. Sure.
So I stole that. But it's all about what are the players thinking when they come into practice? What are the coaches thinking? Because we're coming from two different places, but we got to be at the same place when we're in there. We talk to them about how they step over the line to start practice every day. It starts with that. Where is your mind? We have a term, be here now. We talk to them. I don't care if you had a bad test. I don't care if your girlfriend broke up with you. You are here now. This is 2 hours where you're here to be a better basketball player. Everything around them on the court, there's no banners in there. There's no national championships. There's no pro jerseys. It says play hard, play together, play smart, play with pride. It's the only thing that's on the walls. Attitude behind each basket on the wall. And it's the habit of how do you begin to stretch? Where is your mind? How do you respond to a coach? How do you move from one drill to another? Where's your mind? It's what we do. And you have to do it every day. But it takes the staff thinking about that and being in tune to that to stop them and educate them. So that's what we're trying to teach every day.
The little bit about that stuff that I know, that's not something that works when you do it once, right? That's something
exactly.
that you literally have to do every single
right.
day until it becomes ingrained
right.
in guys in ways they don't even realize it's happening.
Exactly. And now we're, well, over the last 5 years, once you get that established now, the players help the coaches establish that because, as you said, it's ingrained in their mind. It's a habit. Just like if you're a player and you come in and you shoot BS left-hand hooks to start practice every day, that's easy. It's easy to create a bad habit. But it's your habit. It's what you're going to do. And the other term we use is when you get tired, you're always going to resort to your habits. So let's make them good ones. So when you're tired, and that's what we talk about at the end of games, you know. So we – but when we create those good habits, we don't have to talk to the juniors and seniors about how they walk in. It's just their habit. They walk in ready to go. And now the young guys are watching that. So not only are we telling them, but the younger guys are saying, hey, Jalen Brunson does that. Look at – and now this year we're losing a lot of those guys, and we're going to have to kind of re-educate again.
So let's do a little actual basketball conversation.
Okay.
Because this is my podcast, I'm going to give you three ways we need to change college basketball, okay? And you're going to tell me how right I am. The first is, why are we not playing quarters? I don't understand why we are still playing halves. Is there another place in the world that they're playing basketball in 2 20-minute halves rather than in 4 10-minute quarters? That's a change that should be made yesterday.
There's a lot of benefits to that. I believe the reason they're not doing this is what I believe, is over the last few years, there has been an issue about college basketball games going too long. And TV needs a certain number of television timeouts. And if you went to 4 quarters, that would add more stoppages, more timeouts, and the game would go even longer. Everything we're doing is to try to shorten it, the fouls at the end of the game.
Right.
So that would make the games longer.
But
I think every other basketball reason, as you're saying, you should go to quarters. I really think it's for TV.
I get that. But
and the length of the game.
I'm just thinking this out, though. If you go to 4 quarters, one of the benefits is you reset the fouls, the team fouls, at the end of the first quarter and the end of the third quarter. So it will not be a parade to the free throw line. If a team gets in the double bonus in a college basketball game with 11 minutes left, there is a stoppage every 40 seconds every time there's a foul.
Yeah.
So if that resets, I feel like it will go a little faster. I mean, I don't know if I'm robbing from Peter to pay Paul. I can't make these TV decisions.
Yeah.
But from a basketball standpoint, you should be playing 4 quarters. And that's the main reason why, is to reset the team fouls.
Yeah, I think basketball standpoint, we should. I really do. They have those numbers from the NIT.
Yeah.
I also think after doing it, they have evidence that the games go longer.
They do go longer.
They do.
Okay.
And it might also be because they do get into the bonus earlier in the quarters, right? So it's spread out.
So they want to shoot more foul shots.
They're still shooting the same number of fouls. It's just spread out in the quarters.
Okay, so we'll figure that one out together. But for the most part, let's just, for the sake of this discussion, we'll say I was right.
Basketball-wise, I agree with you.
The next, as a lifelong college basketball fan, I believe that they need to change the personal foul limit from 5 to 6. It drives me crazy that a player gets his second foul 4.5 minutes into a game. He is going to be a non-factor in the entire game. I'm thinking of Greg Oden in the national championship game for Ohio State, whenever that was, and who knew it was going to be basically his last hurrah, unfortunately, for that kid. But he got an early foul trouble, and he doesn't even get to play. I personally believe that that is too significant of a factor in college basketball, and they should change the limit from 5 fouls to 6 fouls.
This shows me how much I watch you on TV, because I've heard you say these things.
Okay.
And I'm actually remembering my answers when you were saying.
Okay, let me hear it.
There is an intent in college basketball to make the game more free-flowing, less fouls. What was the game that Wisconsin played in the Final Four? It was years ago. You remember this stuff. Where it was like a 54.
Yeah.
And the game took forever. It was fouling. After that year, they said, we got to create less fouls, make the game more free-flowing. I think part of the concern is if you go to six, it's going to give guys leeway to foul more. Keep it at five. You're going to have to, as a coach, teach, and I think it's actually happening. You have to teach better how to defend without fouling. It's actually making teams less effective defensively. Scoring is up, and the five foul situation isn't affecting teams like it used to. With the time that you're referring to, mm-hmm. with Greg Odom, it was a physical game.
Yeah.
Refs were letting you play that way. So to be effective, you had to be physical. Now, you don't have to be physical. I mean, look at Steph Curry, who arguably could be the best player in the game. He's not, you know, not a physical guy. It's a free-flowing game now. And you don't really see foul trouble being that much of an issue anymore, right?
Not
the one
pros.
You refer to with Odom, but even in college.
Yeah.
You don't see that too much.
The problem I have with it is if one of your players gets a second foul 5 minutes into the game, he's not going to play the whole rest of the first half.
But because of the way game's playing now, that thinking is changing. We're playing guys with two fouls more because the game's not as physical. One of the things we used to fear as coaches with that two foul situation is this game, and you remember, it's the time you're referring to.
Sure.
Like a Big Ten game, like this game is like a mud wrestling game. So he could bump into somebody at any time and get a foul. So I just can't. Now, the way the game's played and called, I could leave him out there. There's not that much contact. He could make it through the half with two fouls.
Okay. So what I heard in that was, you're right, Greeny. So this is another one you agree with me. All right, third one.
You're good.
I believe they need to move the 3-point line back. And I a little bit further out,
yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Because I hear my father in my head. My father was the best sports fan you ever met in your entire life. He hated the 3-point shot, hated it. He grew up watching college basketball, CCNY. My father went to CCNY,
wow.
And was there when they won the NCAA,
wow.
And the NIT in the same year. So I mean, he
that
loved
was late
college.
50s?
It was 1955.
55.
I think
wow.
It was 55 that happened. He was definitely there. And he would always say to me, Michael, this is not basketball. I mean, the objective of the game of basketball is to move the ball to get the best possible shot as close to the basket as you can, not as far from the basket as you can. Now, I'm not willing to go quite that far,
right.
But I do believe the 3-point shot in the college game has become a little bit too easy. It has become a little bit too, for lack of a better word, too significant. Now, it has in the pros as well, but at least, like,
yeah.
If you've got Steph Curry, that is such a unique weapon.
Yeah.
But I feel there's too many kids that can make those shots in the college game. I'd right. like to see them move it out at least a little bit. What do you think?
I wouldn't be against it, but I'm not an enthusiastic proponent. But it wouldn't hurt. Definitely wouldn't hurt. I'm afraid six fouls would get us back into fighting and
okay.
mud wrestling again. But that would not hurt the game. And it would probably help us internationally, probably help the guys transition into the NBA. Definitely wouldn't hurt. But I do – and we're considered a defensive coach. And I worked for Rolly Massimino, and I was against the 3-point line when it came in because we were tough, physical – I love where the game is. It's skill. It's, you know, the players are not growing up trying to just be stronger and take the ball to the hoop and be more physical. They're growing up trying to learn skills. Al McGuire predicted this years ago. I remember him saying the international – it wasn't even international back then because it was only Europeans back then when he said it. The Europeans are going to catch up to us. They're going to catch up to – and they did. And it was when they won the world championship when Larry Brown coached the USA team.
Yeah.
Argentina won. We started to see, hey, if you shoot the three and you spread people out, those threes are more valuable. You can beat a tough physical team. And I hated it, but I love it now. And I think it makes us better internationally. I like the game better, and I like the kids are practicing skills rather than just physicality.
Okay. So, in summary, you agree with me on all 3 points. Okay, fair enough. Final thing. We should end it on something like this. How is everything in college basketball today? If you're a person who only pays peripheral attention to sports, you're reading all of this stuff, right? You're reading about shoe companies and the FBI and all of this stuff. And yet, if you really follow the sport closely and you see it night in and night out, the games are fabulous.
Yeah.
The players are better than they've ever been. The one-and-done thing is what it is.
Right.
Where is the game right? You've been in it basically your whole life.
Yeah.
Where is it right now?
I think it's at a better place than it's ever been, except for the fact that we just had this FBI investigation, and you have to deal with it. Like, That was a small portion of our business, but it's real. And our business is, you know, like pro sports, you know, there's a branding and you don't want it to smear the game. But the majority, and I'll throw out the number 80, 85% of the Division I basketball players, and I'd say 100% of the Division II and Division III basketball players are going to college. They're getting degrees. Our graduation rate is the highest it's ever been for college basketball. And the women's game has grown. The women are doing the same thing. 80% of these kids are getting degrees. They're having great experiences in college. They're growing into better people because of their experience. Now, we've got those issues we got to deal with because there's a lot of money. And I think this has made us open our eyes, and I think what we need to do is get the NBA, the apparel companies, the agents, and college basketball together, because high school basketball, the apparel companies are fine. The NBA is fine. College is stuck in the middle, and we're the ones that are taking the heat for all this because everyone's getting what they want. We're the only ones that have rules of amateurism. High school kids aren't amateur. Sneaker companies are doing everything for them.
Right, right.
We're stuck in the middle. Our rules don't fit. So the apparel companies are going to they're gonna make money. They're going to run their business. The NBA is going to make money. They're fine. But if we don't get college basketball straight and they don't help us, eventually the game's gonna drop. Right now we're good, but we've got to have vision and work together and fix it.
That's the part of it that has always confounded me and frankly frustrated me is in any other quote unquote crime, you are trying to eliminate something that is terrible, right? I mean, you know, stealing cars.
Right.
No one wants cars to be stolen.
Right, right.
This is a terrible thing.
Right.
So we're trying to eliminate that. We are turning people into criminals who are doing things that are victimless. No one is being hurt in many cases. Obviously, there are some individual instances that are genuinely bad things are happening.
Yeah.
But by and large, the impermissible benefits, which it all comes back to,
right,
are victimless crimes where no one is being harmed, and yet they are treated like criminals.
Right.
I mean, you take a guy like Reggie Bush, people you know, from college, it took his Heisman away, they act like he's a criminal because someone gave him some money and maybe gave his parents an apartment.
Yeah.
It's a victimless crime. Again,
right,
I'm not suggesting you should break rules.
No, I understand.
If they're
that's
sitting
a good
there.
Point.
But this is the one instance where they should change the rules as opposed to changing the behavior. You should augment the rules to fit the reality of the behavior, it seems to me.
But see, I think you should be authentic. If you want to play basketball and you feel that your talents warrant you being paid money, and you're good enough, if this is a free market, we should have the rules set up that you can go to the G League or go to the NBA. You don't have to go to college.
Right.
Right? You know, there's no other sport where you do this, not even football, because I don't know if there's a high school kid coming out of high school that's really good enough that wouldn't get hurt if you went and played pro football. But if you're a tennis player, you can come out of high school and just become a pro.
Oh, sure.
You can't do that. We're forcing these kids to go to college. That's what I'm saying. This is getting dumped in the lap of college basketball. I don't want to diminish how important the FBI issue is. We have to deal with that. That's our own people not going by our rules. But it's just got to be authentic. It's got to be, if you're playing college basketball, that means you want to be in college. You want to go to class, right? But if you are good enough to get paid, you should have the opportunity to go and get paid.
I agree. Okay, in closing, we're here at Michael's. What's the specialty of the house? What are we ordering tonight?
Well,
what's good?
Everything's good here. They got special kind of, they got zucchini pizza, which is awesome. But myself, I'm very simple with a little broccoli rabe on the side with some nice pasta and Michael's red sauce, which my assistant, Mike Kakachi, started marketing this when he came here, and now it's going national. The sauce here at this place, you got to get the red sauce.
Yeah, you can buy it all over the country, and people come here to see where it is actually being
exactly
made. Well, Jay, I can't thank you enough for doing this. It was great. It was whatever I was hoping for. It was way better. So
cool.
I wish you nothing but continued success. And thank you very much.
Great,
I really appreciate
with you, Mike.
And so I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jay Wright, the basketball coach at Villanova. such an incredibly interesting person. And again, the very first of these that we did, and certainly one of the most enjoyable. I wish him great success on the coming season, which is now right around the corner. We will talk to you again next week, but I would ask you between now and then, if you have a moment, to do me a huge favor. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe and rate and review this podcast. I'm interested. It would be an enormous favor to me, and it would help us enormously if you would be so kind. Subscribe, rate, and review. The podcast is I'm Interested. My name is Mike Greenberg, and I will see you next week.